Well, you don't have to be a rocket scientist. Stop doing all these studies. Stop being the self-licking ice cream cone of rewarding each other for doing your job, and put that money. I could start it by staffing out the veteran suicide hotline so somebody actually answers the phone and can talk a veteran off the ledge when he or she is in mortal peril of taking their own life. That's a place to start with. Stop over-medicating veterans and start actually treating the problem. This is Jamie Williamson, retired Special Forces Colonel with OPSEC Radio. Tonight we are going to be discussing Veterans Administration issues. Last night I had the distinct pleasure of sitting down with Mr. Donald Trump and discussing some pertinent issues regarding the Department of Veterans Affairs. One of the other guests at the round table was a friend of mine, Amanda Weir, who's with me. And Amanda is a barred attorney and a pro bono veterans advocate who's helped myself and a bunch of other veterans, some known to me personally. Amanda, welcome.
Hi, Jamie. It's great to be with you.
Thanks for joining us. Well, the Veterans Administration is way overdue for, hate to coin a phrase, but for a fundamental transformation. We've had a series of unsuccessful secretaries of Veteran Affairs, but, you know, and Shinseki, I believe, did the honorable thing and resigned after a scandal that he was not able to fix. Bob McDonald, I think, is struggling in an agency where he has no authority as the secretary to fire anybody within his department. And you know, a VA secretary is only as successful as the empowerment that he or she receives by the President of the United States. So I think that's where the key to solving a systemically broken organization lies, is not just words, but deeds and a true, noticeable, and forceful commitment by the President of the United States to fundamentally transform the VA into everything it was envisioned to be. What are your thoughts, Amanda?
Well, I think that with each successive administration, we have a lot of promises that are made to veterans. And the reality is, it's a very difficult problem to tackle. There are the issues with disability claims, with appeals, with health care for veterans, with suicide prevention for veterans, PTSD treatment. There are so many issues that need to be dealt with that we really need to move beyond political promises to an ongoing strategic approach to overhauling the VA and addressing the problems that so many veterans face. It's more than a four-year job. It has to be something that really transcends each administration. And you heard, as well as I did, you have your own frustrations with the VA, and you experienced that firsthand as a veteran, and I experienced it secondhand as an advocate for veterans and through my friends such as yourself and all the guys that we work with. And it really is a very frustrating issue. And those promises that are made during campaign and election time, and when you go in to see your representative, they're not being felt by enough veterans. They're not really feeling that change. Overhauls, pouring money into it, the veterans aren't seeing a difference.
I couldn't agree more. And for the sake of all of our listeners, my personal experience with the VA care system has been very positive. The problem, everybody has their own stories, and I'm not one of those. I'm 30% disabled, and I'm fighting for another 50 to 60%, as you well know. Mm-hmm. But as far as the healthcare workers of the VA, they are doing a stellar job in the face of overwhelming odds, I believe. I've had, you know, 95% of my experience with VA healthcare workers has been very positive in people trying to, you know, they were pleasant and courteous. I mean, my problem is the bureaucracy. The frustration of dealing with, and any time you have a simple procedure that's put in charge, put in the hands of the government, it becomes an unmanageable bureaucratic nightmare just because it's administered by the government. And just going on the VA website is enough to make my head explode, and to try to navigate through that.
Ironically, that was intended to make it easier for veterans. I think it was very well intentioned. I think that most people who are working with the VA, as you said, have good intentions. They want to do good, but you can only do so much with what you have, and you have good ideas that the government puts forward and are implemented, but there doesn't appear to be enough interaction with the veterans who are in their families who are using these systems. As you said, you go online and it's frustrating, it's difficult to navigate, but the intent was it would be easy to navigate. You could file claims easily, you could check on your appointments easily. So the intent was definitely to make this an easier system for veterans and their families to be able to navigate, but that's not translating to the veteran. That's not the experience of veterans that I've spoken with. Many of them, like you, are very frustrated with going on and unfortunately then put it off. Say, oh, I'll get to this later. It just can't be a priority. I have work. I have my family. I have other commitments. I'll do this later. And sometimes for some people, later doesn't necessarily come. And it becomes a frustration for veterans.
Yeah, and I was explaining to you earlier the frustrations of myself. I have a full-time job. I work for a living. I don't have hours and hours upon end to decipher the complexities of the VA's bureaucracy. And you were a tremendous help to me in helping me navigate my way through that. Now, I have a graduate degree. I'm a reasonably well-educated individual. I have access to a computer. You take all these things for granted, but you look at some of the people who need these benefits the most are homeless veterans and the ones of less affluence that have almost nothing, and they don't have the means to even access these, and to be confounded because they don't have the tools at their fingertips. And I feel there's not enough outreach. We have made really good attempts, Florida in particular, where we live. The state of Florida recognizes how broken the VA system is and has set up county veteran assistance centers, the fraternal organizations, the American Legion, the VFW, all assist veterans. Ultimately, it's up to the veteran, him or herself, to go and seek the help out, though.
And one of the issues that we touched upon last night when we were speaking, and after we heard about a dozen veterans talk about their experiences, some good, as you said, you've had a great experience with the medical care through the VA, and that's great. But many of the veterans had expressed some of their frustration with different aspects of the VA. And one of the issues is that follow-up. And getting people to come back in and look at their claims and meet with a representative on an ongoing basis. And that's hard for a lot of people. And as you said, if you're indigent, you have transportation issues. Now, there are some fantastic organizations out there. One of the organizations I did my continuing legal education training through is Swords to Plowshares. And they offer tremendous help to veterans. And there are many more organizations that offer that. But there are so many veterans that need assistance and need consistent outreach and interaction to make sure that, okay, did you get your letter? Did you get your rating? Did you go to your appointment? Did you get the health care? Did you go to your CMP? All of these things are an ongoing process. And we heard from a lot of people last night who were talking about how difficult it is to understand the decision. There's medical terminology, medical diagnostic codes. So it's a legal and medical bundle that you're asking veterans to address while they do everything else they have to do in their lives, build a business, go to work, raise a family, go back to school, or all of those things. A lot of veterans are trying to do all of those things at the same time and get health care, get treatment, file a claim. So it's a challenge.
And 99% of us are laymen in the medical and legal terminology that we're trying to process. For me, like I said, you were of great help sorting through that. You know, oddly, the VA that diagnosed my sleep apnea then, to counter that, said, well, it wasn't service-related.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now, how can that be? So now the burden of proof is on me. I obtained a half a dozen or so letters of individuals that I was in close proximity with. I mean, this went back to the 80s in my case, mm-hmm. where we didn't even know what sleep apnea was at the time. So, you know, now it's just going into the queue for adjudication. It's already been half a year or more, and it'll probably be another half a year, a year or more before it's finally resolved. And in that time, I'm just shy of 57, but there's a lot of veterans where the clock runs out on them. They either die or they give up. Or the situation, you know, I remember going for a dermatology appointment. I had some horrible kind of fungus that I picked up from God knows where and some garden spot of the world. And they're like, oh, they gave me an appointment. I'm like, is there a mistake here? Surely the first appointment can't be 9 months from now.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, they were really overbooked in dermatology, and, you know, and then you have the veteran ending up soaking his feet in gasoline, which actually did cure whatever it was, not the optimum cure, perhaps. But
no, home remedies you might want to avoid there. But that is an issue trying to go back. Especially if you had a short amount of time, it may be easier to pinpoint and locate people that can attest to what happened to you or a particular injury. But another issue that was raised last night by one of the participants was something that a lot of special ops guys will understand. What if there's no record? What if you can't necessarily state where you were and what you were doing when this occurred? There are some things you can't talk about. Field treatment. A lot of guys that I've spoken with, they said, well, yeah, well, I fractured an ankle. I jumped out of a chopper, fractured an ankle, kept running. To give you painkillers, you keep moving. That's your job. Your job isn't to go, oh, could you bandage this up and could you also write this down and make sure that gets into my records because later I'm going to be filing a disability claim and your name is, okay, and all the guys, you'd be dead by the time you'd keep, that's yeah. Not what you do.
In my background in the infantry and special forces, you didn't you didn't go to sick call unless you had bones sticking out of your skin or arterial bleeding. It just wasn't done. The owies and the boo-boos were, you know, you took a handful of Ranger candy, 800 milligrams of Motrin, and you put your head down and you drove on. That was how it was done. Years later, in my 50s, all those skiing injuries and, you know, at the time, I weighed 160 pounds. My rucksack weighed 110 to 120 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a smaller rucksack because I was one of the smaller guys.
Mm-hmm.
But just the normal everyday PT of push-ups and calisthenics and the rucksack marches and the impact on the spine and on the knees and on the ankles, you dealt with it at the time. You iced it down. You took some Motrin. Well, you know, at 56, all those reminders of the past come back to remind you of all those things. And you know, there's no documentation of it. In a special forces detachment, we had two team medics. I mean, these guys were premier medics. They were, in effect, unlicensed surgeons. But they handled a lot of stuff. We were on a training exercise, and Virgil's like, "Damn, James, you've got walking pneumonia." I said, "What's walking pneumonia?" He said, "It's pneumonia when you should be in the hospital, but you're out in the Maine woods walking around on snowshoes." And that's essentially what it was. Consequently, I scarred my lungs from the coughing, and I was smoking back then, but I was a young man then. Now I'm not a young man, and all those things have consequences now at my age.
Especially for guys who are in the field, who are deployed, who are in a war zone, I was wondering your perspective. It seems that that's really a stress-relieving mechanism for a lot of guys.
Oh, it's more than a stress reliever. It's a dietary supplement. You know, smoking would help keep us awake. It was more of a physiological addiction, psychologically as much as physically. I remember, you know, I'd started smoking, I guess, in college. By the time I was at Fort Benning as an infantry lieutenant, you know, I was smoking a half a pack a day. By the time I got to an infantry battalion, I figured I'd slow it down. We'd have staff meetings, and I remember there was, you know, carafes of coffee and ashtrays up and down the table. 2/3 of the people there were smoking. I went to the 82nd Airborne. Thought I'd stop there. Oh, everybody smoked. We took cigarettes in our socks on PT runs, so when we stopped, we were able to light up right away. I smoked through Special Forces. All the scuba divers said it helped expand the lungs. Not sure I agree with
okay.
that. It was rational. You know, and back then, the government subsidized it because you get a carton of cigarettes for dirt on the dollar. There were no taxes, so it was cheap. It was a cheap habit.
And it's something that I've heard from a lot of veterans. Well, okay, I smoked, but then in the same sentence, they're telling me how if they were on a target, you know, or they were out, they were somewhere where they were waiting there. It, as you said, helped keep me awake. It was something that you know, I did because it is a stress release. That was what we did, and it wasn't discouraged. But that's something that's kind of, well, that's your fault. You smoked. But it's part of that stressful experience of what veterans are going through. Infantry, special forces, doesn't really matter. I mean, you're deployed in a war zone. Smoking probably seems the least of your concerns
of
the time.
Exactly. When you might not live to see the sun come up the next day, the thought of dying of lung cancer is far, far from one's mind.
So that doesn't really seem to be something that it's a little odd when you hear people describe that, especially in a medical setting. Well, you smoked. Well, I've never been in a war zone, so I don't know. But as you said, that probably wouldn't be my biggest concern if I was in a war zone. But when you're dealing with all of these issues and all all of the red tape that you have to go through, and as you've mentioned several times, bureaucracy, and the question really does become what we can change. And I was joking earlier, I said it's almost as though you need a buddy system so you can pair veterans up together so they can help each other get through the VA system.
There's value in that. In fact, I had addressed that the other day when we were just in informal discussions that, you know, and maybe this is a good segue to talk about the PTSD problem, which is plaguing us and has direct ties to the veterans' suicide. Mm-hmm. A lot of veterans I know don't want to admit that they have PTSD issues. And it's not because it's not a manly thing to do. At least in my case, that wasn't. We tend to talk to other veterans that have been through the same thing, and we just sort of work it out on our own. The reason why a lot of veterans that I know personally will not ask for help for the VA, because then there's a record of it. Mm-hmm. And it's not so much that there's a stigma attached to that, although that's true in some cases. It takes generations to inculcate that mindset, what we call being shell-shocked in World War One, and then, you know, the Patton slapping incident in the Second World War. I mean, there's soldiers in the American Revolution that had PTSD. We just didn't call it that then. But, you know, the buddy system works for that. And with the veterans dying by their own hands at a rate of 22 a day, that statistic was from 2014. I believe it's down a little bit to 20 a day now. But that's 50% above the civilian demographic. 83% of them are men. And of the 2014 statistics, of the 41,000 suicides that were recorded, 18% of them were veterans, 7,403, to be specific. 83% of those were men, which probably, I'm guessing, reflect the demographics of the force. We've been at war for 15 years now, multiple tours with a much smaller force, as the armed forces have been cut repeatedly, you know, year by year. There's a lot less to do, a lot more. And then if you look at the combat operations, and in particularly special operations being a force multiplier, you know, somehow the presidents seem to think that no boots on the ground doesn't apply to special operations. I'm like, well, wait a minute. This man was shot at close quarter. How could that not be a combat-related death? And, you know, this whole thing, the VA has become a political football. It is something that we see at election time, much like catering to a specific demographic of blacks or Latinos. The veterans fall in that category also. But when elections are over, nothing really gets done because the presidents don't empower their secretaries to fundamentally change the systemic bureaucracy and the parts of the VA that are broken. And I think the bonus system should be eliminated for anybody above the rank of GS-14, which is a lieutenant colonel equivalent. Beyond that, you get into GS-15 and the senior executive services. You're a public servant. You don't need a bonus for doing your job. Just do your job. And the bonuses have had a negative effect and have corrupted the VA. As opposed to it being egregious things like covering up veterans' deaths because somebody's going to lose their bonus, or it'll reflect poorly on their evaluation reports, shredding records. I think everybody's pretty much aware of all the horror stories that have come out of the system. And it gives the VA, I think, a really bad name, where it's an organization that's trying to do a good job in spite of its own leadership and bureaucracy. And those employees, as well as the veterans they serve, deserve far better than that. So it's got to transcend politics.
Absolutely. And dealing with crisis, as you mentioned, how many suicides happen every day, we do have to prioritize. That should be an absolute priority, addressing that. That's not something that you can wait to do a study and figure out what can the VA change or what programs can be implemented. You really do have to accelerate that and make sure that people are getting the treatment that they need, the outreach. As you said, that there are people that are following up with them. You're not waiting for them to reach out and say, this is too much. And for people such as myself, who've never been in that situation, haven't gone on multiple deployments overseas and into war zones, one of the things we don't understand is the toll that takes over time. And what you don't see when someone comes home, even when they're perfectly physically fine, on the outside. And I've spoken to some veterans who, one of the things that weighs on some veterans is if they don't think I don't know what I was doing over there, seeing so many of my friends that we lost, the devastation, and in some sense that has an effect on some of the veterans. We have another issue which you may be familiar with because you're now in the contracting world, but we have veterans who, when they leave the service, now they go into the contracting world, and they're going to these war zones as contractors, but they're not going over as military. So they're experiencing this, they're getting injured, but they're not getting the same treatment when they come back as when they were in the service, they had been injured. And I think that's something that we need to look at as well, because we do have a lot of veterans whose second career is, again, government contracting, and doing the same job in civilian clothes.
That's a really good point. And since you bring it up, I look at my own experience. I was over with the Gulf War. I was deployed for a year. I spent a lot of time living with the Kurds. It was a very short war. Most of the deployment was provide comfort, and the months following the war, living with the Peshmerga in northern Iraq. Since then, though, the majority of my deployments have been as a contractor into combat zones, and I would go on active duty as a reservist with active duty units, and I had to sort out the conflict of interest with JAG that, you know, in the middle of a deployed tour as a contractor, that I was going to get my, at a minimum, my 2 weeks time in, to get the minimum amount of points. And it's hard to separate. You know, people mm-hmm. say, well, how many times have you been deployed? I couldn't begin to count because I wasn't deployed for 6 months or a year at a time. My military deployments were shorter. My deployments as a contractor serving those special operations units were the long term. So it all blurs together after a while. But you're right, and the other thing, it's not, you know, we look at the veterans themselves, but there is the second and third order of effects of the spouses of, the children of, the employers of, and as an employer, how do you deal with a veteran? The Carrie, the young lady that was next to me, was talking about assimilating the veterans back into the workforce, and how the transition period, somebody comes from a combat zone, from a year's deployment, they out-process, and they're back on the block, and it's a different world.
You're listening to the America Out Loud Talk Radio Network. Well, it's where we say, let the silent voices be heard. You'll find a whole host of shows and a lineup of great content back at AmericaOutLoud.com.
The individuals who are on the Department of Justice's banned gun owner list were referrals from, guess where? The Veterans Administration. So these are PTSD patients that have been labeled mentally defective and therefore are not able to purchase guns. So whether it's real or perceived, the perception is there.
That's something that's been mentioned to me, because I obviously, if I'm helping with a disability claim, I go through a checklist of different both primary, secondary conditions, and inevitably, especially with the special forces, special operations community, if I bring up PTSD, that doesn't make it past PTSD, and then I'm cut off. Nope, move on. And yeah. I don't really even get a chance to, okay, well, let's talk. Nope, not. I'm not saying that's everyone's experience, but that's been my experience. Is there is a very strong resistance in a lot of veterans to discussing that, bringing it up, because they don't want a label that many people associate with a negative aspect of violence, and which is inaccurate. It's not an accurate depiction of what someone means when they talk about PTSD. The experience is different for everyone. And there are different contributing factors. You mentioned traumatic brain injury. We're understanding more and more about traumatic brain injury and also developing new and unique treatments. And that's one of the things we need to focus on, is not just disability ratings and compensation pay, but the effective treatments, cutting edge treatments available to veterans on an ongoing basis that can help them address different issues. Not just a medication that you give them, this will make you feel better, or this will make you less anxious, but a holistic approach to healing our veterans, not just a focus on, well, let me rate you for your disability, because that's the other thing that the feedback I've gotten, especially career military guys, I don't want to be broken. When we go over this list of what's wrong with me, and you're trying to help me make sure that I get all my claims in, all I see is I'm broken, I'm past my prime, and this is depressing, and I don't want to do it. And that's some of that resistance, and it can be difficult to get past. There's asking for help, which most people don't want to do, or maybe they'll ask once, but they don't want to keep asking. They can do it themselves, you know, very self-sufficient. That's what you guys do. And then to see that on paper, for some people, the feedback I've had is, it's really kind of depressing to see that. That's the sum total of my career, is what I'm seeing when we're going through that. Now, I mean, obviously, for the rest of their time, they know that they've done amazing things and served our country proudly. But in that moment, they're seeing everything that's wrong with them. And that's hard.
It's not just hard. It's exceptionally counterproductive. And here we're back throwing the political factors into the equation, where an administration may see veterans. There was an actual study done. It was a Homeland Security study that had put combat veterans in like the same category as white supremacists and preppers, and you know, as being a threat to democracy. Where my my version of it is those are the individuals that are patriots and would take our country back when our own government tries to subvert that democracy. So in that case, perhaps they're right.
But I think that as more and more veterans are becoming politically active, and I think that's, I know what you're referring to, and I haven't seen the study, but I have heard people murmur about that there's this potential threat to democracy. But honestly, I think the biggest impact that returning veterans will have is becoming more involved in politics, especially because when they experience things that with the VA or with any other agency that they find frustrating. And again, the people who work at these agencies do so much. So not trying to undermine what they do at all. But as veterans have these experiences, I think we see more veterans getting involved in the political process, because veterans, I think by their nature, want to fix things. There's a problem, we'll fix it. Let's develop a course of action. We'll go ahead and we'll fix it. So that might be that course of action, is more involvement in politics. And if you guys won't fix it, well, guess what? We'll get elected. We'll fix it.
And it's a wonderfully refreshing thing to see on both sides of the aisle. Democrats and Republicans alike, young veterans that have been elected to the House and the Senate, because they're an important part of the American demographic. And you're absolutely right. These are take charge individuals that I can fix this, or I will damn well try to fix it. And God bless them for doing it. I think we're, and to have the younger generation involved and to have that veteran perspective is extremely important. It's extremely important to the welfare of the United States. I've often thought, you know, I like the idea of the Roman Empire, where in order to become a citizen and have the right to vote, you had to serve in the Legion. You know, we used to have a draft, and I think there's some merit in that.
Well, I'll have to disagree with you on that point, because I couldn't carry a ruck to save my life, so I would be out immediately. So I'll disagree with you on that, but definitely think that if we can get and support not more veterans in getting involved, and it's not just those very high profile elections for federal government positions or state government positions, it's in your community, getting involved at the grassroots level in your local politics. That can make a difference too, because it does give you an opportunity to do outreach, to interact with state and federal officials in a way that you don't as a private citizen. And encouraging veterans as they come back, even if you don't feel that you're going to run for Senate, look around you in your local politics. Is there a board you can join? Yeah, even at your children's school, is there a parents board, so that you can get involved and help shape the future of our country?
And I see that every day. It's much easier to do at a local level. Mm-hmm. OPSEC's former president, Navy SEAL Scott Taylor, I personally recruited him to be the president of this organization, and we'll determine on the 8th of November, but it looks like he's going to be the next congressman from the 3rd District of Virginia.
Wow, that's amazing.
And I'm proud of him on many accounts. Proud that he was the initial president of OPSEC, and proud that he's a go-getter. He's a young man with a great future ahead, and he truly cares about this country, has a deep passion for the nation and its people. And when I say its people, that's all of its people, mm-hmm. Republicans, Democrats, Independents, and we've got to get back to that. The partisanship is just ripping this country apart.
And most of us are closer together. As you know, I'm I'm a Democrat, so we usually put that up front because I do attend a lot of events with the Republican Party. But that's one of the things I think was really great about the things that I've gotten to do with your community is the community comes first. And you can leave your politics at the door because it is about the betterment of the community doing things. And not just the veterans community, but the community that veterans live in, their families, their spouses, and our citizenry. So it's not just about a narrow demographic. It really is about making a difference. And that, again, transcends, as you said, it transcends partisanship.
And we love you anyway, despite being both a lawyer and a Democrat.
I know. I'm from New York, so I'm a Yankee to boot.
Well, you know, I would have been happy had I had the opportunity to sit down next to Hillary Clinton. I would have taken that opportunity and would have told her the exact same issues. Mm-hmm. The discussion last night, as you well know, was not a political discussion. It was a veterans issues discussion.
Absolutely. It was not about getting a particular politician into office, and that's not why anyone was at that roundtable. We were asked to come there to talk about issues that are important to veterans, to those who support them, who advocate for them, their families, and it was, I think, very cathartic for people to be able to tell someone who's running for president of the United States what was important to them. And you're right, it wouldn't have, if Hillary Clinton had said, I'd like to stop by too, I don't think anyone, but come in, please, we would love to tell you. This is what's important to the veterans sitting at this table and thousands more. That's what's important. I think anyone would sit down with any politician who was willing to listen and wanted to find a way to move forward and improve the VA, improve outreach to veterans. It's not a partisan issue. There are many veterans who are Democrats, as you said, independents, and Republicans. So
I was really happy to see that Pam Bondi came in. For those that don't know, Pam Bondi is the Attorney General for the state of Florida, and she has been a very proactive AG that's done a lot in as far as pushing legislature, protecting the citizens of Florida. I thought it was great that she showed an interest in this and was there. The Florida National Guard is deployed. They're a combat arms unit, primarily infantry. They have been deployed more than any other state. So there's a huge, and I have no idea what the percentages are, but these are your citizen soldiers that do their weekend drills once a month, and they're 2 weeks in the summer. And I've worked with National Guardsmen in Iraq, and I was assimilated. We were looking for HVTs, one of the Saddam sons in particular, and I had a team of MPs from, I believe it was the Illinois or Indiana National Guard. Top turret gunner was a female. She was a college student that worked at Subway. the platoon sergeant was a state trooper. The lieutenant was a municipal cop, and some of the soldiers were cops, and some of them were not. But combat being the great equalizer, you know, after everybody's done their turn in the barrel, so to speak, you don't know who's active, reserve, or guard, and it doesn't really matter because they're all combat veterans, and those skills, regardless of the training, combat is the great equalizer among men and women. And uh, I assimilated and identified with these people. We were doing house clearing. I had never trained or worked with this unit. But when the adrenaline is flowing and your life is on the line, I grabbed the shotgun and off we went and started clearing buildings room to room. And it was the... It was probably more done through intuition and eye signals than actual hand and arm signals. But afterwards, I thought about that, and I said, wow, that was really kind of a cool thing. But some of the other, to pivot here, I wanted to share with the listeners some of the other things that were discussed last night, and to give the listeners an idea. We had a former special mission unit, former CIA officer in the Army. He had CIA service, became a Navy psychologist for SEAL Team 6, worked in Dead A in Berlin, old school. We had two young women, single mothers, I believe, recently transitioned and going to school. We had contemporaries of mine, Special Forces folks, Terry Summers I knew, Fifth Group, and then Chris himself, Vietnam era, Special Operations. We had Mike Marino was an employee of the VA. And he actually called me today and interviewed me for an article he's writing. So we had another a husband and wife, Marine wife, Army Vietnam vet. So there was a lot of different experiences. And who knows?
And a Gold Star father.
Yes, Gold Star family that lost their son. So a good spread of male and female and ages and different branches of service. But the one thing that unites us all is we're all veterans and we all have the same goals in mind at the end of the day. And I think there were some ideas that were presented. One of the things that I mentioned was fix the root of the problem. Don't mask the symptoms with medication. That's another reason why so many veterans are taking their own lives. They get over medicated, and that's the easy solution. Just dope them up and make them feel good and let the pain go away. I don't want that. I want my spine fixed. In hopefully in the least intrusive way possible. When I had a good insurance plan, thank you, Mr. Obama, I couldn't keep my doctor and I couldn't keep my health care. In fact, I don't even have my insurance policy anymore. I'm relegated to relying on TRICARE Reserve, which sucks. And I'll get TRICARE for life, but not for 3 years until I turn 60. So I have to deal with it. But there was a time where I was able to, on my own medical plan, I was able to get steroid injections and put surgery off. I have no discs left between the 4 and 5 vertebrae, and I can feel them grinding together. I went to the VA, wanted them to fix my back. They sent me to the pain management clinic, which is a euphemism for, we're going to dope you up so you don't feel the pain. I want no part of that. You know, they have an obligation, as far as I'm concerned, and they need to fulfill it. Gus Bilirakis is my congressman. He sits on the VA committee. So there's strength in numbers, and a lot of voices together will be heard much more forcefully than individuals crying in the darkness for help. So I would encourage people to look at a lot of the fraternal organizations, whether it be the Legion or the VFW or the 22 Project. There's plenty of organizations out there. There's institutions and there's individuals such as yourself who've advised and taken veterans through the the painful navigation of the VA system. I've relied on you. I've relied on the Florida Veterans Services, both of which have been extremely helpful. Just to get certification from the VA as a certified service-disabled veteran, oh, my God, it was one of the most painful things ever. Having a letter from the VA wasn't good enough, saying you're 30% disabled. And, you know, all I had to be was 1% disabled, but months of preparation and taxes and bylaws. And then I look at these other companies or individuals that have fraudulently presented themselves as disabled veterans. And I watched Tammy Duckworth, a Democrat congresswoman, eviscerate this guy that had received millions of dollars in VA awards fraudulently, tens of millions of dollars. She destroyed this guy. And, you know, God bless her for doing that. I mean, here's a woman that was grievously injured in combat, permanently disabled, 100%. And for him to have invented some story, you know, in ROTC, he never followed through with the program. He had a knee injury or something. And from there, grew this myth into a service-disabled veteran. But there's so many abuses in the system. And the VA in 2013 had a $78.4 billion with a B dollar budget. Well, you don't have to be a rocket scientist. Stop doing all these studies. Stop being the self-licking ice cream cone of rewarding each other for doing your job and put that money. I could start it by staffing out the veteran suicide hotline so somebody actually answers the phone and can talk a veteran off the ledge when he or she is in mortal peril of taking their own life. That's a place to start with. Stop over-medicating veterans and start actually treating the problem. We discussed the burden of proof. For the veterans, what were some of the other, you know, besides streamlining the bureaucracy and giving the administrator or the secretary firing authority, what were some of the other things that came out of the discussion?
It wasn't about bashing the VA, because that's, again, that doesn't get us anywhere. What we wanted to do was say, these are the issues, and this is how we want to move forward. And a lot of people, especially with PTSD and with the issue with suicide, yes, we absolutely need crisis hotlines, enough that are staffed with well-trained individuals that can help veterans in crisis. But it's before they make that call. So it's the solutions. It's finding effective ways to deal with the problems. Backlogs, which we still have a backlog of claims, and I think that's to be expected. The appeals process for the disability claims. You've mentioned pain management clinic. A lot of guys, when they're referred to that, go, or men and women, say, okay, I'm going home. That wasn't what I wanted. I wanted, for a lot of veterans, it's, I wanted to go see a chiropractor or a physical therapist. I want to get better. I don't want to take a handful of pills every morning. I want to go and do something proactive. And I think that was really the kernel of everyone's discussion yesterday, was we want to do something. We want to move forward. We want to find effective solutions.
If I could leave the listeners with anything, if there's a veteran out there that, if you feel that you're in a bad place in your mind, reach out to somebody. If it's not the VA, if it's not a crisis hotline, at least reach out to another brother or sister and talk it out and get some help. You're listening to OPSEC Radio on America Out Loud Network. I've got Amanda Weir with us. Amanda, thank you so much for your insights and everything that you do for us veterans.